Hey everyone, it's Cam Hurt, host of the Best Show Ever podcast, and we have got a second season coming out very soon that I am very excited about. We've got some very cool special guests, including musical acts that we all love, like Karina Reichman, Daniel Donato, Jake Brownstein from Eggy, Rick and Peter from Goose, and many more. Tune in for new episodes dropping on Osiris Media March 5th on the Best Show Ever podcast.
Welcome to Wheels Off, a show about the messy reality of the creative life. I'm Rhett Miller. That's when it got wheels off. We started up and we ain't gonna stop. Us, I like it or not. That's when it got wheels off. In the world of terrestrial radio, we have a couple of subsets. We have this sort of nationally kind of syndicated, computer programmed pop stations where you know what you're going to hear. We have political talk radio where, for the most part, you know what you're going to hear. And we have a handful of outliers. One of these is the station out of Dallas, Texas that I listen to pretty much every day. I listen on my phone via an app called Sports Day that's hosted, I think, by the Dallas Morning News newspapers, also an institution that has taken a hit in the modern era. But this terrestrial radio becomes this sort of international thing via this app, and I listen to it wherever I am in the world. I started listening when I did live in Dallas, Texas, for this station is based in Dallas and has existed for now 25 years. They started within about a year of my band Old 97s starting, and pretty quickly they became the biggest talk radio station in Dallas. They are, on paper, a sports radio station, but they're a lot more than that. They're probably what would be called nowadays a lifestyle talk radio station. A lot of it does center around sports. A lot of it centers around Dallas sports. Even though I moved away years and years ago, a quarter century ago, I still follow Dallas sports teams and root for those teams. So that makes it easier for me to listen to The Ticket because I want to know what the Dallas Stars are doing. There is one host on that station in the morning show, which is their highest rated show on this highest rated station. There is one host who doesn't even like sports, as far as I can tell. He is what they call, in the parlance of that industry, a yuck monkey. I feel like this sort of belittles his contribution to the show and the station. His job is to create characters. He also does segments where he brings the news, talks about local issues, but the main thing that people expect from him and love him for is the way he creates characters. Sometimes these are characters that he's mimicking, local characters, Jerry Jones, Jason Garrett. Sometimes these are characters he's created out of whole cloth. Marge the swimming coach, Mushmouth, the ticket mouse. Sometimes he uses effects on his voice to help, you know, these characters sound even crazier, weirder. Sometimes he just does it with his vocal cords and his acting ability. He is my funniest friend. I don't mean to offend any of my numerous comedian or funny friends. And I do have a lot. I'm not bragging. I'm lucky I get to hang out with a lot of comedians, a lot of funny people. But man, Gordon has a thing that is just otherworldly about what he does. In a way that when I watch a magician do close-up magic, and I can't believe that he's doing this right there. I should be able to tell how he does it, and yet I can't figure out how he does it. The same can be said of Gordon Keith. Gordon Keith is a magician, when it comes to mimicry, when it comes to character creation, when it comes to comedy. Spontaneous, improvisational, ad-libbed. It's just crazy how funny he is. And I think a lot of that goes to how intelligent he is. And we end up talking about this in the interview, how empathetic he is, how open he is to the world around him and the real life characters that inhabit that world. I loved getting to talk to Gordon. I've known him well for years, but I've never really sat down and picked his brain as thoroughly as I do in this interview. Please welcome Dallas radio talk show host, our Marconi Award winner, beloved by denizens of Dallas and people of the world. Please welcome to Wheels Off, the great Gordon Keith. Welcome to Wheels Off, Gordon Keith.
Thank you for having me here.
Thank you. Right away, you make me laugh. So I've explained to our listeners who you are because some of them don't live in the North Texas area.
Right.
But I'm so happy to be sitting across from you right now in your Airstream on these nice microphones you've provided us with.
By the way, this is not standard equipment in an Airstream. The mobile studio. This is something I did special. It's a bespoke Airstream for me.
So we always start on Wheels Off with what creative project are you working on right now and how is it inspiring you?
Creative project that I'm working on right now. You know, I've just kind of started diving back into writing, which is interesting because I'm, as you mentioned at the top of the show, which I really enjoyed that intro that you did, you know, I'm mainly known for radio. Radio is my main gig.
Yeah.
But writing is my passion and my love. And I always feel most at home when I'm writing well. And so to dive back into that means a lot to me. And it's the most rewarding thing. I don't know, for whatever reason. Of course, you have creative writing in your past, too.
I do. I like it. And I know you've written a lot of essays over the years. Is that sort of what you're delving into now again? Kind of personal essays?
I'm getting into more of the short story. I want to do more short stories. I don't know why. It doesn't seem like, do people read short stories anymore other than teachers? This seems to be the main reading audience for short stories.
I think they do. And I think a lot of fiction that comes out now under the guise of sort of a novel will be like a collection of short stories. Jennifer Egan had a book called The Visit from the Goon Squad. Mm-hmm. And that was all short stories that were sort of nominally connected to each other. But I think short stories, they say it's the purest art form in a lot of ways.
Well, you would think with our shorter attention span that short stories should be more popular than books or novels. But it doesn't seem to have gone that way.
I mean, are any of them really that popular even anymore?
No.
I just
found out what a book was like 2 weeks ago. I'm like, is that a long web post? What is that?
I feel like when you do segments, especially when your segments in character, a lot of that, I'm not saying it feels written, but when I imagine you doing like a really long piece, it feels like you must have written this out. Like when you sit down to do those, do you give yourself a full script? Are there bullet points?
I think I write, I would say probably 80% of the character I do is written. You know, you always like to have something to go to if in case the improvising skills don't work out for you, you aren't able to come up with something good. So you always, I like to have my jokes and there on the page where I can make them. And then I improv about 20% of it.
That's fantastic. And, do you wind up doing those like in the couple of segments leading up to that segment?
Yeah, I always write those characters probably in the 15 minutes beforehand before I perform them. I should, and I want to learn how to work ahead a little bit more, but I learned very on in the radio show that if I wrote something the day before, by the time I get to the next day, it's real stale and I don't feel a lot of energy for it. But if I write it right before it, like I think, oh, this is going to be really good, I actually have some energy behind it and some confidence in it.
Well, it feels fresh.
Yeah.
And you're able to do little callbacks to maybe segments that have been
exactly
right before it.
Right.
I mean, it's a weird collaboration, though, because you obviously depend on your on-air partners to bounce things off of.
Right. And sometimes they don't give me the feed lines that I need for the punchline that I have that's going to be so great. And then they forget the feed line and I have
But you do give them the feed lines ahead of time.
Yeah. I'll say, like, you know, hey, after I mentioned that I collect crickets or something, you need to ask me, do I still see my grandmother? You know, it'll be some kind of thing that they need. And I need this in order to get to this next show. That's not a real example. I don't know if you're able to pick up on that, but that situation's never occurred.
I'm writing a skit in my head right now.
Cricket collector needed to mention one of their ancestors. But anyway, so is a grandmother an ancestor?
I think it's a...
I mean, like, it is technically, but we... Like, how many generations do you have to go before you're comfortable using the word ancestor?
Maybe if she's dead, then it's more likely.
Great-grandparents... Great-great-grandparents are certainly your ancestors.
Absolutely.
But then when you get to great-grandparent, did you know any of your great-grandparents, by the way?
My one great-grandmother, who was still alive, and she was like a trailblazing Pine Bluff, Arkansas woman.
Wait, she's still alive?
No, she was when I was a little kid.
She was at one point and still alive?
I remember her, I guess is my point.
Oh, okay. All right.
What about you?
I met my great-grandmother once. She was the only one that I ever met, and it was interesting. She had had quite a hard life and had lived in a mental institution her entire life.
Right? Did she probably got shock treatments too?
You know, I wonder. It's been very hard to get the records from back then, but she lived in. She kind of went crazy in her 20s and would be in and out of mental institutions. And my great grandfather would get her out every once in a while, and it seemed like it was basically just long enough to get pregnant, and then she would have another kid. It was a really strange story. That's actually one of the stories, the family research that I've done. There are some really crazy things in my family's past, and I want to write those things out in long form before I shuffle off the mortal coil here, because I did a lot of talking to a bunch of really old people about 15 years ago who still remembered parts of these stories and had witnessed these incredible events that had occurred. And so I did all this research for it. And I'd love to put that in kind of a book about what life was like. It was around the turn of the night. It was the beginning of the 1900s.
And these people have all probably died.
Yeah, they're all kind of like your great grandmother.
Yep.
Dead now.
Ancestors. So dead.
Yeah, ancestors. They're ancestors now. They once were living people.
I feel like whenever I ask this question, I feel like such a noob, as my kids would say. But I do end up asking this of people who write. You like to write on a computer? And I mainly ask you this because I know you have a typewriter.
Right.
Fetish, can I call it that?
I have a writing implement fetish.
Yeah.
So basically anything that you can produce words with. It's like I've gone through and I have, I probably have 300 to 400 typewriters. I don't use them all, but I had to get one of everything where I could see which one I liked the most. I worked on them. I rehabbed all of them. And now they just sit in storage. I also get into, I just showed you right before we came in here, how I've gotten into old IBM keyboards for computers, for the early personal computers.
They're all clickety-clackety ones.
Clickety-clackety ones, right. They're mechanical keyboards, and it even predates the Model M, which is a very famous IBM keyboard. But that one that you used was an IBM Model F that came with the XT computer. And it's one of the holy grails of mechanical switched keyboards. And I found it at an estate sale just right around the corner for $5. And so, now you buy them on eBay for close to $200. But what I found one for $5.
What do you think it is that makes those so collectible and beloved?
It's the typing feel of them, because each switch is a mechanical switch. And so you get this tactile feedback when you're typing on them. And it just is a much more pleasurable experience. And they just feel so different than today's modern keyboard. It's very strange that computers got a lot better and keyboards got a lot worse. Mm-hmm. Like that keyboard, when it first came out with that computer, it went for like the equivalent of $1,000 today just to buy a keyboard for
Wow.
Yeah, it's insane. And of course, I have mechanical pencils. I've bought every kind of pen there was in the world. I go through these OCD phases where I have to research and learn everything about this because I'm just fascinated with writing implements.
Do you think you do that because you think that if you find the perfect implement, it will make the writing easier, better?
Right. It's twofold. One is it's a complete waste of time and a distraction and an avoidance of getting words down. And the other thing is, yeah, when I do find something that I do really love, is I want to interact with it. And that always leads me to writing and leads me to producing something.
Oh, that's great.
So, yeah, if I get a keyboard that I love using, or I get a pen and a notebook that I love to fill it up, you know, and I love to write. And so it's kind of the thing that they say in music, which I think you're involved in music somehow, right?
Yeah.
Okay. They say, you know, every guitar has a song in it. Yeah. You know, you pick up a new guitar and you'll end up playing it in a little bit different way than you would your other guitar, you know, an acoustic versus an electric. So they can be inspiring. The actual tools that you use can be inspiring and change the way that you create. And I found that to be true with writing stuff, too.
And sometimes when you're stuck on something, if you just switch from one guitar mm-hmm. to another guitar, or the Bob Dylan quote was always, if I start writing something on a piano and I get stuck, I move to guitar, or vice versa.
Yeah.
And it unsticks you just a different way right. of thinking. But this has come up probably because I've asked this question of writers, but I know with Michael Chabon and Harlan Coben both had interesting takes on this, where the underlying message was you can't get hung up on the medium, you know, what you're using. In fact, you know, with Michael, his whole thing was, you know, I'll write on a computer, or a laptop, sure. But if I'm on a plane, I'll write on an iPad. And if I'm in the car, writing in a car, I'll write on my phone.
Right.
And Harlan Coben, his thing was kind of similar to Bob Dylan's, where it was, if writing on a pad is working for me today, I'll write on a pad. Mm-hmm. If writing on a laptop, you know, and it's just whatever works.
Whatever works. Exactly.
But I know it's like you're saying, a lot of times for me, I'll use the excuse, well, I would love to write today, but I don't have my laptop.
Right.
You know, and it's that stupid thing that we do to ourselves.
It's BS. You know, and that's one of the magical things to me about writing as a creative endeavor, is that with a pen and a pad, you can create a world.
Yeah.
I mean, it's one of the few creative things that requires so very little to actually make something of enduring value. And that to me just seems incredible. You know, I think it was Stephen King who said this. He called books, you know, a unique kind of portable magic. And above everything else that I do, when you write well and you think that this, here it is, something that only requires a pencil and a pad, and then I can time travel, and then I can write something that somebody can read 200 years from now, and it can transport them. I mean, books that were written hundreds of years ago, if you read them and you can do this time travel of going into a different world, and it's immersive. And it's one of the most efficient forms of creativity, in the sense that I don't have to write much for your own mind to finish populating that world to make it bespoke to you. And you can get immersed in a story, and your mind, the reader's mind, is doing a lot of the heavy lifting of creating that world that you're creating in fiction as a writer. And I just think that everything about writing to me just seems like incredible magic, and it's available to all of us. Which is so fascinating to me. I mean, I've taken, you know, somebody who didn't think that they could write and said, okay, here, take 10 minutes and here's this writing prompt, and I want you to make, I'll give them a little bit of scenario and a little bit of conflict. And I say, just write something crazy, something stupid. And at the end of it, they're thrilling. Something thrilling has happened in them, that they've created this thing that's so silly and they didn't think they could write. And everyone can write if they just let loose. I just think we're just so white knuckled that we can't. That's when we're trying to maintain it. You know, that's when we start white knuckling it. That's when we start collecting a bunch of computer keyboards and things like that. But yeah, you can do it on any instrument, you know, and sometimes the instrument helps you. And then it's up to you to recognize your own BS and know when the instruments and the search for them is distracting you from making the music. I think I just mixed metaphors. But yeah.
But speaking of, mm-hmm. you know, all these different things, you're a pretty great musician as well. Like, you've gone down a lot of self-improvement rabbit holes when it comes to learning to play guitar. Like,
right.
Really difficult guitar.
Mm-hmm.
You've written songs.
Right.
You go out sometimes and perform music. I mean, you do a lot of things. I mean, obviously, you're best known for your work on The Ticket and making the characters. And it's kind of ironic that it's technically a sports radio station and you are not a sports fan.
I skipped over the learning about sports part to get a job there. But yeah,
you're probably your most famous character on there is the fake Jerry Jones.
Yeah,
I'm guessing.
Yeah, that guy's given me a career. Just the fact that we had Jerry Jones in this in this town is just the most ridiculous JR surreal owner. And yeah, it's just been wonderful for us to have that character.
I think it's funny, though, knowing you, but then also listening for years to your work on the radio. I feel like if I played these characters for people, like nobody would believe that this was all the same person. Mm-hmm. Like, so you inhabit these other bodies. And I feel like what you're doing is incorporating a lot of different performance styles, you know, from the writing of it to the acting, all the voices, the improv ability that you're displaying constantly while you're doing these things. I wonder, when you were a kid, was there a moment where you knew that like this weird multiplicity of talents converging into this characterization, like you can become these other people? Was there a moment where you knew that that was what you were going to do for a living?
I always did a lot of this stuff because I have a brother and a sister, and we would just imitate our family members, our extended family members. So anytime we were coming back from a big family reunion, we would come back and just improv these plays doing all the different voices. And and my brother and sister are good at it too. And so it just felt natural to do that and to see if you could get, because it was not only getting the voice down, but getting their content down and then getting some facial tick that they have down. And so it's fun just escaping into those other characters and just improvising around. And I always found like my mind just tended to work longer in it, long after everyone else had set aside the let's imitate people. I was still in character, you know, and still doing it. And I just couldn't get it out of my mind, you know, so I wanted to keep doing it.
Do you feel like your dad being a preacher, there's a performance mm-hmm. element to that? I mean, do you think watching a father be a sort of a performer, is that something that seemed like it made it a viable career path for you?
You know, I mean, still to this day, I mean, he's passed away now, but I still marvel and I'm amazed at how he can get up there, how he could get up there and speak in front of people for, you know, 20, 30 minutes. And he would do it with, he would just kind of make himself an outline that then he would never even kind of refer to, you know, he wasn't a write out every word kind of guy. And to speak extemporaneously to me, that also seems like magic. And it's very interesting to me how a lot of my, you know, I consider you a friend, although I don't really know what you do or what your last name is, but I consider you a close personal friend. But it's like all these people in these different creative elements marvel at what the other one can do. And to someone like you, it seems so natural to get up there and play, do a solo gig, and you're playing and singing your guitar and it's no big deal. But somebody else who is somebody that you may admire may go and see you and just think that is just, how does he do that? That's incredible. I mean, that just seems so amazing. And you look at something that somebody else does creatively and you just go, God, man, I just don't understand how they do that, you know? And I always did that with my dad. I was just, how he could get up there, and a good preacher is much like a great monologist or a storyteller. To captivate an audience with just your voice and a microphone, and you can have everyone, and you start examining the techniques in which they do that, when they start talking quieter, more pauses, and you start leaning forward in your pew, you know, as a listener, you just, they bring you in and draw you in and can just impact you so much by speaking. I still can't do what he does did. And I've always wanted to try it just to see if I could ever get up there and do it, but I've never done it that way. And yet some people look at what I do on radio and think, well, how does he do that for 4.5 hours and just talk and everything? But I don't know. To me, it seems easy to do that part of it. Whereas if you put me on stage for 20 minutes while everyone's looking at me and I had to speak for 20 minutes, I think that that seems more difficult to me. I don't know why.
I've got a handful of friends that are stand-up comedians, and I always look at their job and think, to me, that's got to be the hardest. Mm-hmm. But maybe, you know, being a preacher without like completely reading a script, being an extemporaneously speaking preacher, mm-hmm. that maybe that's even harder. But you're walking. I mean, I guess with comics, they've got material and they know that they can go from bit to bit and they've worked out the timing on stuff. And, you know, maybe a preacher has some of that. They're working from a text, ideally. But, yeah, it's terrifying. It's terrifying.
Right.
But it is funny how people in other jobs, it's like the, it's some alternate variation of the grass always being greener.
Mm-hmm.
I remember years ago, I got to have dinner with Tom Brady. It was right after he won his first Super Bowl. And I've always been a sports fan. Roger Staubach was my number one growing up. And so I finally let myself geek out for a minute and say, so what do you do? How do you, you know, you look at the cornerbacks over there and the safety, and I'm asking him these questions. And he's like, dude, I watched you play the other night and you did that song Question. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I wish I could do that. I could never do what you do.
Right. Like, and that's Tom Brady.
Yeah.
You know, who's sitting there looking at something you do. And yeah, I mean, it's like that. I mean, anybody who's good at something looks at somebody else who's good at something and feels like, oh man, oh, why can't I do that? Why, how is that? That just seems so far out of my realm of doing things. And basically anything that is amazing or good or great, all of us think that we can't do it. But yeah, the ones who do it are the ones who just show up and just, it's like, I don't even know, if you told me that I had to do 4.5 hours of radio tomorrow and I thought about that for a second, I would get daunted. But when it's just like, oh, that's just the thing I got to do, you just go in and you do one step at a time, and then you turn on the mic and you just say, well, I'm just going to say this one sentence. I'll say this next one. And that's how you add up to doing something that makes a career. You know, that's how you write a novel. You don't write a novel. You write 200 words at a time, or 500 words, or whatever your word count is for the day. And it's like, greatness is just an accumulation. It's not a one huge burst. It's always what leads up to that. It's the one drop that hits the bucket that tips the bucket over. But that one drop wouldn't tip the bucket over if it hadn't have been for the 10,000 that happened before it.
God, I love that. That is true. It's in a way we trick ourselves, right?
Mm-hmm.
You say, I've done 4.5 hours of radio. However many times, thousands of times, I can do this again.
Mm-hmm.
I've walked out on stage, and that was what, in the end, that was when I pressed him. That was what Tom Brady said. He goes, I don't know. I did it every single day in high school, every single day in college, and I've done it for, he's just, I look out there, I see it. It's easy.
Right.
It's easy for you. It's easy for you because you've done it.
Well, look at you though. I mean, look how many songs you've written. That is just so mind blowing to me. Like, I've probably written, I don't know, 30 songs in my life or something, you know, back when I was in bands before the radio. And you've just written so many songs, and the way you write them is basically, I mean, I know you get bits of them going, but it's one at a time. I mean, you just write. And pretty soon you've written a whole bunch of songs. And people like you amaze me. Anybody who's prolific amazes me. You've written a lot of songs. Stephen King has written a lot of books. Larry McMurtry has written a lot of books.
But I wonder sometimes, and in a way, I won't say I feel bad for you, but there's something about, because you're as or more prolific than anyone I've ever known. You wake up every day at 4:30 in the morning. You go from 5:30 until 10, and you do, you know, you're not doing every segment, but like, I don't know, 6 segments a day, mm-hmm. where you're just killing and you're making up this brilliant stuff, but it goes. It just goes away into the ether.
I know.
And there's some guy at Unticket who's maybe capturing some of it, or right. You know, some late night board op who's putting up, you know, little podcast snippets for people on sportsday.com to go listen to,
uh-huh.
Ticket archives. But it's very effervescent, you know? I mean, maybe that could be said of someone who's doing sports or whatever, but I mean, it's, do you think that makes it easier or harder? Do you think that, does it ever kind of hurt your soul that you're making such gold and it's just flying away?
Yeah, you know, I'm of two minds on that. That used to bother me.
Yeah.
And that all of this stuff that I'm doing is disposable. I actually think I have the worst of both worlds in this, because because it's like, for 4.5 hours, when you're on that much every day, you know, it's supposed to be disposable. I mean, you can't do, you know, I'm not doing it for the ages. I'm doing it for today.
Yeah.
Right. There's certain jokes that work today that are not going to work a week from now, particularly with our accelerating culture, of course. Now, standards change very quickly, and stuff isn't meant for all time. But yet we have this problem now where I'm doing throwaway radio 4.5 hours a day, and it's being saved for all time, which means that it's not, you can listen to a bit, you know, that happened 15 years ago. It's not going to hold up today, and it doesn't hold up to today's standards. And comedy itself is always a reflection of the moment, for the most part. There's some comedy that transcends generations, but for the most part, comedy doesn't age well. No. So, I mean, I think I get the worst of both worlds in that I do disposable radio that's been preserved on these websites that keep it around for forever. So, but
I don't feel like you've ever gotten in trouble. I probably shouldn't bring this up. I don't think, but I can't think of like a scandal involving some bit you did that went horribly wrong or aged really poorly.
Right. I've never gotten in trouble, but I think that the way these things work is that for the audience they're intended to, they understand the context that something's set in. But more and more today, we get in situations where things are taken from one particular context and then moved over, and people start listening to it out of context, and then it doesn't sound so good. But who knows, man? I don't know if any of our art will survive us. Who knows? It's just fun making it.
I know. I think it's so. It's so, what's kind of vain to think that, oh, well, my art's going to live on forever.
Mm-hmm.
But it, I don't know. I'll take 10 years. Give me 5 or 10 years and then I'll be dead. I don't care.
Yeah, it'll probably be about 5 years after you're dead before question finally it falls off the whole I proposed no, listening to it.
You know what'll happen is 5 years after I die, some giant country star will cover it. And then
and he'll get credit for it. Yeah. And it'll be his, you know, hey, you heard that new whatever his name is.
Just so long as
Colt Travis
kids get some money.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Colt Levi.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Johnny Western.
So I've known you since we were both really young, both playing like the Rhythm Room. Mm-hmm. When we were in our, you know, early 20s. And I do know, as much as your persona on the radio is that you're like this, you are actually a he-man. Like, you're so capable in terms of yard equipment and, you know, tractors and things like that.
Building houses and stuff.
Exactly. But I do know, and I don't mean to out you, but I will, you've got a very delicate nature in a lot of ways. You're like a really sensitive person. And so I wonder, because outside of North Texas, you don't have to deal with it as much. But especially like in this town and in this area, you're such a well-known figure. And I'm sure sometimes stuff comes back at you. Like, do you have to deal with, like, I don't know, the slings and arrows of not just outrageous fortune, but other people, as Sartre said, hell is other people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, do you feel affected by it, or do you feel like you've insulated yourself enough from them? Does it hurt? Does it hurt, Gordon?
Does it hurt? Does it hurt? You know, I think I responded to the station's popularity probably worse than anybody on the station. I think I got way too private, way too isolating, and it's not good for you to be that isolating, and I wanted to be invisible, so I started really staying inside, and it was, you know, now it doesn't seem so bad, but when I was doing a lot of TV stuff and all of that, you just don't boy, this sounds it's so bad to complain about this, but it is an interesting aspect of being human that sometimes you just don't want to be seen, you know, and that's tough. I mean, that's really tough when you go out and you don't want to be seen. You may be dressed real schlubby, you know, and now we got creep shots going on and everything. And it's like, well, I don't want to think about that. I think that I don't know. I don't know that I was really designed for any sort of notoriety.
But I wonder if part of what makes you so good at what you do is that sort of insular fly on the wall. Like, you want to be an observer and separate.
Yeah, see, because there's competing things, right? You know, when I do the writing stuff, which the writing stuff I generally have done has been more serious stuff. You know, it's more, and you know, a writer really depends on that observation thing, mm-hmm. and so does a mimic. You know, when I was mimicking people and learning how to imitate people, I always loved, when I was a little boy, I just remember watching people. I'd watch my parents' friends, the way they'd move. I'd want to understand why they would say what they would say or do what they do, or, you know, it was interesting how that old man had a every time he would say something that was a little bit vulnerable, he would always kind of twitch his left eye, or just, you know, little observations like that. I was always looking at adults trying to figure out the world. And that is like, I think that it goes against the fact of when you become known for something and then everybody's looking at you, you lose your ability to look at other people because you're having to perform. Whereas a lot of times you just want to sit back and restock your well of observation. And that doesn't work when you go to a bar and everybody wants to buy you a drink, Rhett Miller. Hey, love you, Rhett Miller. And you just want to sit there, just kind of look at people for a little while.
I've always been aware of, obviously, the concept of empathy. But it's only, I feel like, recently when I keep hearing people talk about empaths as people who are, like, overly empathetic, mm-hmm. or that really depend on empathy for who they are or what they do. But I do feel like so much of what you do is, like you talk about, the old man, whenever he says something vulnerable and you see his left eye twitch and it's like a tell. And for you, who's really paying attention and feeling this, what's going on with the old man, like it's like a little window into him and you're like accessing something really private. But I feel like there's got to be like an other knife edge to that, or like there's a downside to that empathy, right?
Oh, I think there's a huge downside to that. I think that a lot of the, you know, what a lot of us do is drink as a result of it, because yeah. you end up feeling real heartbroken for people.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, everybody's a walking heartbreak. I mean, and you just, it's in their life somewhere and you get their story. And I always love striking up conversations with people on the, you know, on the bench, just sitting out there, some stranger, you know, and you start asking them about their life. And there's just like, everybody's life is a novel almost. And none of them think it is.
Yeah.
None of them think that they said anything interesting that's happened to them. And then you start talking to them. They tell you about how, yeah, you know, you have any brothers and sisters? Oh yeah. I have, you know, two sisters and had a brother. Oh really? What happened? Oh, six. And he died in a farming accident. And oh, really? Did that and everything? Yeah. And how'd your parents respond to that? Well, you know, my dad, he kind of stopped talking, I guess, for a couple of years. I haven't really thought about it. But yeah, I guess he kind of stopped talking. And they're off telling this story that you just think sounds amazing, that they went through this and they think that nothing remarkable has ever happened about their life. But, you know, I just hear this heartbreak of this 8-year-old boy who lost his 6-year-old brother to this farm accident. And then the dad that used to play with him out ball every day on the weekend, or on the weekends, you know, stopped playing with him and stayed locked up in his room a lot and started smelling more like medicine, you know, or whatever the story is. You know, I get all heartbroken for this stranger on a bench of when he was 8 and his brother died and his parents went into the shell and then he lost him until he became a man at 18 and left the house. To me, that breaks my heart.
Yeah.
So I'm interested in it and I sit there and ask enough questions till I get to the heartbreak and then I'm heartbroken hearing it. It's like a curse. So that's why it's just easier to drink.
Well, it's funny. I used to, before I ever really thought about it on a deep level, I used to think when people would say alcohol is a depressant, I thought what that meant was that it makes you feel depressed.
Mm-hmm.
But I've learned, and I could be wrong still, but I've learned that what that means is that it just pushes everything down so that you don't feel anything. It's like a tongue depressor mm-hmm. depresses your tongue, mm-hmm. just pressing it down.
Oh, yeah, that's interesting. I've never heard that idea.
I mean, I don't know that I even learned that.
It makes some sense because what did we do? You and I both don't drink anymore.
Yeah.
But I mean, I always used to drink to numb myself out and get that kind of oblivion going and, you know, stop worrying about things. But yeah, you would press all those feelings down. And what happens when you're not drunk is you wake up and all of a sudden all that stuff is undepressed. And you're like, man, I'm depressed because I've pushed all that stuff down. And
yeah,
to think about it, you know, I had that line in one piece that I wrote about how we're all born, you know, 2 beers shy of happiness. And I really think that's true, man. When you had those first 2 beers and, you know, the world was warm again and you were back in the Garden of Eden, you were back in the mother's womb of love and everything felt good, you know, and just. Then it just got so hard to get that right moment and to make that moment last because you tip over into being too drunk and you're sloppy and you're talking things about you shouldn't talk about and you're making a fool out of yourself. And, you know, what's that old, this one's not enough, and or what is it? three's not enough and four's too many or something.
Yeah.
That's the way it gets for drinkers. It gets so hard to get that right amount anymore of that perfect feeling that you once had.
Well, the
had
line keeps
to.
Moving, mm-hmm. right? You know, right. Two beers is perfect. Well, two beers doesn't even start.
Right.
It's tricky. And obviously that was what made me start thinking about the question of what is a depressant then? Because I was like, I don't know, man, when I drink, I am a happy person. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't that. It was because it was just pushing back and rendering all those feelings of all the awareness of the heartbreak was mm-hmm. rendering that inaccessible. And if I don't have access to the, you know, myriad freaking heartbreaks that are all around us at every moment. But now that I don't drink, you know, and I mean, you're the same way. It's a little bit hard to be out in the world because, I don't know, I get, and I don't know if this is a product of getting older or having kids that are teenagers, but I wind up in situations all the time, every day these days. I feel like I'll come across something that makes tears spring up at the corners of my eyes, and I just think, I can't do this. You know, it's too much. Just being a human being is too much sometimes.
Mm-hmm. And it all ends. You know, it all... I have a real hard time at night, and in the morning is when I get real, I don't know, freaked out.
In the afternoon. The mm-hmm. night, morning, afternoon.
Yeah.
But why? Because you're like kind of alone in the universe?
Yeah, and things start replaying in my head. You know, the look on my father's face when he was dying, that always crosses my mind at night. And just thinking about what my parents thought when they were young and had these little kids. And, you know, talk about heartbreak. I think having any parent, you know, having a child is an inherent heartbreak because you're introducing this kid into the world in which they are going to experience so much suffering and pain. And, you know, whether it's a broken heart because the girl or guy didn't like them back and you know, they're going to lose a job and they're going to lose their spouse to cancer or whatever that's going to happen in their life. You know, it's like this beautiful little creature, you know, that's going to be wilted by the world and you brought them into it, ugh. You know, but your job is just to love them and to bear that heartbreak. And you start experiencing it when they start growing up and they start divorcing themselves from the Eden of childhood. When you start seeing that, when the magic of childhood starts wearing away, that's, I think, when the real heartbreak starts. It did for me when I was growing up, you know. I mean, it's like things are enjoyable and it's let's go play down in the creek and everything seems fun. And I think what screws us up is puberty. You get puberty happening and then, you know, all of a sudden the world is not never the same again. And we spend the rest of our lives, some of us spend the rest of our lives trying to deal with the heartbreak of growing older of and I'm talking about growing older from when you exit that special place of childhood, when you get graduated into the world of suffering.
Yeah.
And you got to watch your kids go through that. If you're lucky, you get to watch your kids go through and grow up to be old enough to have their heart broken.
God, it's so
wait, isn't this supposed to be uplifting? Let's talk about something uplifting.
Well, you know what? We've actually come to the part where normally I would wrap it up. There are some people that do these, I always hesitate to say podcasts because I feel like that's such a yucky word.
Why is that a yucky word?
Because it's so of this time. Mm-hmm. I feel like, do you remember when blogging and vlogging, mm-hmm. that was a big thing?
You see, I thought this was a vlog. Is this not a vlog?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't see the word podcast aging well. But I know a lot of people do these, like the Joe Rogans of the world, where they will talk for 3 hours.
Yeah.
But I've wanted to keep these short, and like I would never truncate our conversation here. But this is about the time when naturally it comes to an end.
Well, edit out my answers. Just have it be you.
But God, I keep sitting here across from you with these nice microphones and our fancy headphones on. I keep thinking about being tempted to do a thing where, and we could go back and edit this out, me asking you this, but I keep thinking about James Lipton. Didn't he get embroiled in a Me Too thing?
I don't think so, did he?
I don't know. I'm throwing him under the bus without even knowing.
And he's still alive in like 94 or something like that?
Okay, but an Inside the Actors Studio type of thing. Because I'm always so fascinated by your ability to become these other people. Mm-hmm. you remember in the Inside the Actor's Studio where he would say, "Can I talk to?"
Oh, yes. I always hated this, and I always thought I would never go on Inside the Actor's Studio because of this.
Well, then we'll skip it.
No, we can do it. Come on.
All right.
For you, Rhett, whatever the last name is, of course, my close personal friend.
Okay. Could I talk to Jason Garrett?
All right, Jason Garrett, he kind of talks like this, and he kind of repeats things like this. I'm right here. It's good to be here with Rhett Miller. You've been such a positive influence in so many people's lives. So many people's lives. I'm not exactly sure what you've done to be positive, but I'm just going to say it anyway, because I'm a robot, and I talk positively about everyone, and that's what we do day in and day out. It's a process in order to be positive, and that's what we do. That's what we do in all three phases.
That's fantastic.
Garrett just goes on and on like that. Where he's just,
it's like a filibuster, right?
It is. It's total filibuster, yes.
There are people listening to this that will not have heard The Ticket, but there was a thing during the First and 10 TV series where we realized that Jason Garrett was an overcusser.
Yes.
And so on The Ticket, your Jason Garrett said some wild things that had to be bleeped out.
Cussing that didn't even make sense.
But
all right, listen, big ass up. I want to get some breakfast in here. Let me get some breakfast. I want some of those. Can I say it? I don't even know if I can say it.
Oh, you know, I've actually tried to keep these pretty peachy.
Good.
But so
he just referred to blueberries with a very odd bit of cussing ahead of them.
And the best part was that recently one of your cohorts on The Ticket revealed that he had always thought that that was an actual recording, because your mimicry is so perfect of Jason Garrett. He thought that was an actual recording of Jason Garrett. And so Mike Reiner, kind of your boss, is basically on there going like, "I can't believe you said that."
Right.
And that was you.
And we were all appalled going, Ryan's actually thought that that was really Jason Garrett. And then I started hearing from all these listeners. They were going, wait a second.
That wasn't real
Jason Garrett? Yeah, they had missed the original bit that we had done that day.
Your Jason
and so
Garrett
they just
is,
heard it over and over in the drops. And so they thought it was real Jason Garrett.
It's pretty incredible. I mean, I'm sure that mimicry is a thing. And that there, I mean, obviously the Daryl Hammonds of the world and these people that are, you know, but Your Jason Garrett is so good that, of course, they think it's Jason Garrett. And I guess he would have said BF and blueberries.
Right, yeah, would have been a bad cusser.
I'll only make you do one more. And, of course, I have to ask, may I please talk with the fake Jerry Jones?
Okay, so this is an interesting one.
Okay.
And I'll tell you why it's interesting.
Okay.
All right, now we're right here. We're talking with Rhett Miller. Who, of course, does a podcast, and I think that term's going to age really well. Podcast, really well. I'm smiling and I'm being tried when I say it, but I am saying it, and it's fun, and now we have a good time.
That's starting to kill my throat. So the weird thing about that Jason, that fake Jerry thing,
yeah,
sounds to me, it sounds almost nothing like him.
But now, when people think of Jerry, they think of your Jerry.
Right.
Nationally.
Yeah. It's really weird. It's that whole, the Dana Carvey effect.
George Bush, Dana Carvey.
Dana Carvey, who would imitate people, and Dana Carvey would just up the heroin on every one of those characters where they would get so caricature and cartoonish. But yet everyone who then imitated that person afterwards would do Dana Carvey doing that person. And that's the way the fake Jerry has become, certainly here in North Texas and nationally, too, in the sense of, because like Troy Aikman and Joe Buck and Frank Caliendo and a lot of these national figures listen to our bits, and so they do the fake Jerry based on the fake Jerry that we've done for all these years. So it's funny to me that such a cartoon version of Jerry is now the way that everyone does fake Jerry, because he
actually talks a little bit more like this and has a full voice that comes out, and he talks and you know, I've turned it over to Steven, and, you know, he's got a real voice.
Yeah.
He's not all down here, blah, 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 doing all that stuff.
It's almost like a lot of Johnny Walker Black or whatever. Like
right.
Maybe late.
Yeah, get that real whiskey voice down in here and everything.
Oh, it's so good. And you don't have to call him out, but you've busted other people for basically kind of ripping off your bit.
Yeah, people will be traveling and listen to some sports radio station, I don't know, Cleveland or somewhere. Yeah. I know it's happened down in Houston, and they'll, man, they've, they not only took the concept, you know, because these are public domain figures, and I can sure. understand them doing a character and then calling it fake Jerry because it's fake and that's the guy's real first name. But then you start hearing the actual jokes that you did that week. I know, they just take it wholesale and just repurpose it for their market, and they get someone, one of their guys, to do the voice. And
it's radio. Good luck with that.
Yeah, good luck with that. I never pursued it.
Okay, so finally, when you and I first met, we were probably both about 21 years old, mm-hmm. roughly. If you could talk to a 21-year-old Gordon Keith in today's world, mm-hmm. which I know it's actually probably you and I have an easier time visualizing this than some people might, because we both have kids that are not far away from that age. But if you could talk to a 21-year-old version of you, what advice would you give yourself?
I actually think that there's no way I would listen to any advice from me now. So I think that that's what frustrates me about the thought experiment, is that, man, I couldn't say anything that would make a difference and that would change my course. But, you know, I would say to be a servant of your talents a little bit more, and not think of it as your talents are there to serve you, but kind of the other way around. And I think you'll be more productive that way. If you realize, you know, you have some good qualities and you can make people happy with those qualities, that the talents that you have aren't there to make you happy. It's like, it's there to make other people happy. And then that will make you about 40 times more happier than if you're just doing it for your own glory and your own enrichment, you know. I think that I would tell him something along those lines and then watch him roll his eyes and say, who's this old fat guy coming up to us at the bar here? Prattling on about how he's me in the future. There's no way I'm going to end up looking like that and being that way.
Well, I really appreciate being here in your Airstream with you. I mean, I feel like I could talk to you for, I could do a every day for a month and still just be plumbing the depths of Gordon Keith's mind. Thank you so much for being on Wheels Off.
Well, thank you for flying out here in the helicopter here in the desert where my Airstream is parked right now.
That's right. Don't try and find us.
Yeah. Don't try to find us. It's very secret. Thank you, Red.
Bye.
All right. Thank you so much for listening to Wheels Off. Please be sure to rate and review the show on iTunes. That helps us appear higher in the search results and lets other folks know that it's a cool podcast to listen to. Also, as the kids say, don't forget to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or anywhere else that you listen to shows like this so that you never miss an episode. This has been Wheels Off, and I'm Rhett Miller, encouraging you to create every day. Thanks, y'all.
This is the story of Whitney Houston.
This is the story of Kurt Cobain.
Of George Michael, of Otis Redding, of Amy Winehouse, of Michael Hutchence, Bob Marley. This is the story of Prince.
It's a new podcast series.
About how they died, why they died, and why we're still talking about them so long after.
It's like nothing you've ever heard before.
It's storytelling.
But it's more than that, because rock stars,
they tell us how we feel. They change our mood.
They change the clothes we wear, the people we hang out with,
the way we remember things.
It's them who give us those ludicrous moments, the ones where you're
jumping around, singing your heart out, feeling understood.
And it's those moments we'll help you remember, the ones you're thinking about right now.
That feeling.
That feeling.
It's coming soon from Crowd Network.
Just search for Death of a Rockstar on your podcast app
and subscribe now.